Morning, everyone. The marshal will introduce the panel.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Jessen, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Thank you. And we're appearing, of course, remotely as we have been for many months. And so welcome to the virtual Court of Appeals for December 3. We have five matters on our calendar today. This is the first of two oral matters. It's A20440 John Edward Warrington versus Karen Lee Warrington. And the process for counsel is pretty much the same as if we were all together. Where you see the marshal right now, he'll be showing the clock so that you'll be able to see that as he's demonstrating now. So of course, appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes for respondent's counsel, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal if you choose. If at any time we lose both audio and especially audio, but if we have some technological difficulties, then he's instructed to stop the clock until we can get you back on board. And we do ask that when you're not speaking, if you would mute, it seems to help a bit from the technology standpoint, and we'll do the same other than when we're asking questions. And so I believe the only other comment I'll make is we are recording this proceeding as we generally do when we're live, and so any other recording is prohibited unless pre-authorization is given by the judicial branch. So we appreciate your attention to that as well. And if counsel are ready to proceed, I'll ask counsel, when you do begin your discussion, to identify yourself for the record. So we'll start with appellant's counsel, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Honor. Matthew Gilbert, representing appellant Karen Warrington.
Very well, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Matt Gilbert. I represent Karen Warrington. The parties were previously before this court as a part of appellant's appeal of a prior district court order that was reversed and remanded on March 30th, 2020 by this court. The current order being appealed was entered before the March 30th Court of Appeals decision. The March 30th decision involved financial issues, while this appeal involves custody and parenting time issues. The parties have one joint child together, Cooper Warrington. In July of 2017, the parties were divorced by entry of a judgment and decree following a two-day trial. Conclusion of Law 5 of the judgment and decree requires respondent to produce to appellant his bid results and flight schedules to determine parenting time during a particular month. Respondent's court-ordered parenting time was approximately 40% of the time as set forth in the judgment and decree. In April of 2017 and before the judgment and decree was entered, respondent took a promotion in Memphis, Tennessee as a line check airman. In October of 2017, respondent moved to Memphis, Tennessee for his promotion. Just prior to that, the minor child started boarding school at Cardigan Mountain in New Hampshire.
Mr. Gilbert, if I could just interrupt you a moment. You made reference to the flight schedule, and I realize that's one of the issues that's raised as alleged error by the district court. Isn't it true that if I understand correctly from the record, the son does not want visitation with father. Father's not forcing visitation given that situation. And is not the schedule regarding flight schedule specifically for the parenting time, which is no longer occurring. So how would there be error for the court in not requiring that if parenting time is not being pushed?
Your Honor, in analysis of the best interest factors, the seventh factor is the ability of both parents to exercise parenting time. And in addition to that, he's pursuant to conclusion of Law 5, he's court ordered to produce the flight schedule. There's no way to determine what his ability is to actually exercise any time with the minor child without having his flight schedules.
So if I may follow up on Judge Sleater's question, that was one. I also had questions about the past flight schedules. I mean, I understand looking at the best interest, how the fact that respondent didn't produce the flight schedules could be important, but why is an abuse of discretion to not order him to actually talk about, and well, what would it have been in the past?
And Your Honor, he's court ordered to produce the schedules. He didn't produce the schedules. Again, analyzing the seventh best interest factor, there's just no way to do that without knowing what his work schedule actually is.
But that goes to what it was during the period of time where it's undisputed he didn't produce them and he didn't see their son, right? Isn't it? I mean, if you're looking at going forward, how does that, what his flight schedules were for 2 years, you know, deal with the, what it will be?
And many times pilots have specific schedules. They might have international flights that would not permit parenting time. Again, these were documents that were ordered to be produced. I've never had a case where someone refuses to produce what their work schedule is. It's entirely relevant to the, again, that seventh best interest factor, and it's absolutely relevant because he's already been ordered to produce the schedules. And he does have some discretion in terms of what his schedule may be. But again, I do not believe he can dictate exactly when and where he works in terms of how that happens. Either way, we need to look at the schedules to see what he's actually capable of exercising as far as parenting time.
Excuse me, this is Judge Cochran. I have a follow-up somewhat related to the other questions. Is there any indication in the record that father has indicated that he will not exercise parenting time? I mean, I know the record indicates that the child does not wish to see the father, but from reading mother's affidavit, it appears that she's alleged that father's failure to exercise parenting time has caused disruption in the child's life in terms of trying to plan for spring break and other vacation periods. So is there any indication that father will no longer be exercising parenting time and so that disruption is no longer an issue?
Father has previously identified he's unwilling to exercise parenting time unless it's in a therapeutic environment.
Okay, thank you.
And along with that, Ms. Warrington has made two different claims in support of her motion to modify both custody and parenting time, the first of which is that the minor child has integrated into her home in the manner that she has exercised 100% of the parenting time since August of 2017. So for over 3 years, father has not exercised any parenting time. That's an undisputed fact. This was briefed in appellant's memorandum of law. I've never had a case with more compelling circumstances for a modification of parenting time in custody when a parent just will not exercise parenting time. Yes, sir.
With regard to that, I did notice that integration into home was not a part of the motion. I did see that the phrase was used, but as you just used now, it seemed to be tied with parenting time. And I also, in looking carefully at your client's affidavit, she doesn't make reference to integration into the home. And so my question is how and what would be the abuse of discretion if the primary evidence the court is to review, which is the affidavit, does not talk about integration. It did talk about parenting time, and it almost strikes me that perhaps that somehow we were conflating parenting time with a motion to modify the joint physical custody order. What would be the abuse of discretion if she makes no reference in her affidavit to integration? And I have kind of a follow-up question with regard to that, because you can see from the court's order, the court really emphasized that the reason parenting time did not occur is because of the unilateral decision to send the son to a boarding school. That would suggest that there's been no change in amount of time that he's spent in your client's home. And she doesn't refute that in the affidavit. And so what fact would show that there's been an integration into her home since the dissolution decree?
And Your Honor.
And I'm referring to comparing it to a boarding school where he's in neither party's home.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with some of the analysis, and Ms. Warrington's reply brief on page 4. She specifically cites her affidavit, which is filed under AA11, and she states, "Respondent and I have also reached an agreement, whether implicit or not, that I will care for Cooper and be his custodian. The agreement is evidenced by respondent's refusal to exercise parenting time with Cooper and me being left to make custodial decisions on his behalf." In appellant's motion, she just requests to modify custody as well as parenting time. Her memorandum of law discusses at length both her integration claim as well as her claim to modify custody based upon Ross. And in that, we firmly believe the court, given Cooper's age, should adhere to the wishes of the child. And it'd be cruel to have him be forced to participate in a parenting time and a custodial arrangement that he does not want. Along those lines, Ms. Warrington, as a part of this initial motion, the district court is required to take all factual allegations as true. Ms. Warrington describes in detail how the effect this current schedule of this non-parenting time has had on the minor child. In Ms. Warrington's affidavit, she describes the present non-parenting time plan that Cooper is subjected to negatively affects his mood, his well-being, his physical health, and his emotional health and development. Respondent seems to be intent on creating scenarios that paint Cooper or me in a negative light. In October of 2017, 1 month after Cooper started school in New Hampshire, respondent orchestrated a phone call to Cooper's dorm room and taped a portion of their private conversation to use against Cooper. Respondent used this recording as an excuse to not exercise any parenting time with Cooper and not contribute to any of Cooper's extracurricular expenses. This act totally destroyed the child's trust in Mr. Warrington. And to better answer your question, even though the child is in school out east, he does have many breaks throughout the year, which is evidenced in Ms. Warrington's affidavit. He's home with Ms. Warrington 4 to 5 months out of the year. Between summer break, there's an extended spring break, which I think is a full month. So there's ample time. In addition to that, you know, just because he's out school out east doesn't mean that he's physically living solely out east. Ms. Warrington does go out to see Cooper. She goes and sees her son. There's no reason why Mr. Warrington cannot do that. Many parents live in different states, but they still exercise parenting time. So just because Cooper is in New Hampshire doesn't mean that Mr. Warrington cannot exercise parenting time.
So if I may, Mr. Gilbert, yes. And this follows up on Judge Sleeter's question as well, I think. The district court here really looked at endangerment, it seems to me, and not so much about directly at the integration question. You know, perhaps because it wasn't, I mean, I understand there were references that you could read that way, but it wasn't as directly teed up. You can weigh in on that if you think that's true or not. My question is more, assuming we think that the district court does need to take another look at this situation, should we be sending it back to the district court and saying, look, you didn't address the integration question, just the endangerment. So go back and look if there's enough evidence there to warrant an evidentiary hearing. Or do you think that we have, without the district court first looking at it, the ability to say, you need to have an evidentiary hearing on the modification motion based upon the integration issue? And I hopefully will get respondents' answer to that question in her presentation as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. And again, there's no factual finding. There's nothing in the court's order addressing the integration issue. This was an issue that was fully briefed by appellant. This issue was also, again, addressed in her affidavit, identifying that there was an agreement that the child would be integrated into her home. Again, this is the initial hearing. There's an ample record before this court. The court can easily make the finding that taking all these factual allegations is true, which the court's required to do, that there should be an evidentiary hearing. It should be reversed.
But you just talked about the Court of Appeals making a finding, and we usually don't
do that. I'm sorry.
Court of Appeals.
And I acknowledge that when these types of cases have been challenged, courts review, as I understand, they review many of these cases de novo, because again, we do have a very ample factual record before the court, and the district court is required to take all these factual allegations as true. And again, all we're asking for is an evidentiary hearing consistent with both Ms. Warrington's integration claim as well as her claim to adhere to the wishes of the minor child. It's really a fallacy at this point to pretend that the existing parenting time schedule, where the husband's supposed to have 40% of the time, should remain in place. It's caused uncertainty, it's caused anxiety, it's causing emotional harm to the minor child because he doesn't know when or if he'll actually see his father. And the father hasn't filed a motion to for assistance of any kind with parenting time. He's all but abandoned the child at this point. It's been over 3 years. Yes, Your Honor.
I have a follow-up to Judge Jessen's question. Is the affidavit sufficient to establish make a prima facie case of integration, given that the language of the statute requires that the child has been integrated into the family of the petitioner with the consent of the other party? So is the allegation that the agreement was implicit, is that sufficient to make a prima facie case?
Yes, Your Honor, and there's case law to that effect that integration can be implicit. And if you don't exercise parenting time in 3 years, you're agreeing to what's going on, to be frank. And Ms. Warrington identifies that in her affidavit. This is the agreement that they have reached.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Warrington also provides an affidavit from the uncle of the minor child. It looks like I'm about to run out of time here. Also identifying the endangerment that the child faces because of the endangerment of Mr. Warrington. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister Gilbert. And you'll have opportunity in the rebuttal to with 5 minutes as well. And counsel for respondent, if you would identify yourself for our record, then you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Ann Hansa, attorney for the respondent. May it please the court, I represent the respondent, John Edward Warrington. As the court is aware from having reviewed the documents in this file, the parties were divorced in July of 2017. The one issue that the parties actually did agree upon was the label of legal custody. Legal custody was a stipulated label. The label of physical custody and parenting time was a contested issue that was decided by the court following a 2-day trial. I think it's important to just correct some of the facts. The promotion that counsel references was not a promotion that affected respondent's parenting time or his job. It was simply an added duty that he was teaching other instructors during his regular flights. He did not move to Memphis for his promotion. As the court is aware, following the entry of the judgment and decree without respondent's knowledge or consent, the appellant in this case moved the minor child and enrolled him in a boarding school on the East Coast. And that's really the crux of what has happened in this case. Without my client's knowledge or consent, the appellant moved the minor child to the boarding school on the East Coast. There was litigation that ensued. My client ultimately was faced with a horrible choice. Do I force the child to come back to Minnesota, pulling him out of the school mid-school year, or do I allow him to stay there? Respondent made the very tough call and allowed the child to stay in the boarding school. Mr. Warrick, the respondent in this case, has not abandoned his child physically.
Counsel,
or
Ms. Hansa, sorry, did I mispronounce your name? Can you?
No, that is correct.
Okay. But can you clarify for me, you know, given the mother has alleged that father has not seen exercise parenting time since August 2017. And she has basically been the sole parent since that time. So why isn't the affidavit sufficient to make a prima facie case of integration for purposes of the statute?
Well, first and foremost, I don't think the integration claim was pled out, but as I read the affidavit, that frankly, the child hasn't integrated into the appellant's home.
It talks about integrated into the family, not the home. And clearly the child has vacation time, and there's no indication that father has spent any vacation time with the child. In fact, it's not, I think father indicated it was impractical, but I don't think father indicated it was impossible to spend parenting time with the child. So it appears, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it appears from the affidavit that the child, to the extent when the child has time off, the child is with mothers, not father.
That is accurate, Your Honor. That is accurate. But in terms of an integration claim, the major reason that the child is not with my client is due in part to the fact that he has been enrolled in the boarding school. And the other component is the fact that the child has been unwilling to participate in counseling. The original judgment and decree required the minor child to participate in counseling. My client has been trying for 3 years to participate in counseling with the minor child, and that piece has not, the minor child as well as the appellant have been unwilling to make that piece work. The primary issue before the court is whether or not the district court erred in denying the appellant's motion to change the legal custody label, the physical custody label, as well as the parenting time, and whether the district court erred in denying an evidentiary hearing. In this case, I think that the court made appropriate findings to support its conclusions. On appeal of a district court's denial of an evidentiary hearing, or Court of Appeals must look at three distinct discrete determinations: whether the district court properly treated the allegations of the moving party as true, which I think they did. The court order is very clear that it reviewed all of the allegations of the appellant. I think part of the issue, and I think one of the justices raised it, is the affidavit and the notice of motion and motion did not specifically make a pleading that the change was based on an integration. That word only appears in the memorandum of law. The court also properly
Ask you, Ms. Hansa, in response to that, isn't it true though that it did, there was discussion about integration during the oral argument, the hearing before the district court judge? And by both counsel, I think both of you made reference to it, and I believe the judge had a couple of questions regarding integration. Would that not be sufficient to at least suggest it's properly before us? And secondly, would you agree that district court did not address integration in her order?
The answer to your first question is that the oral argument at the district court, in my opinion, is not evidence. It's argument, and so the court, in order to consider an integration claim, had to look at the evidence in the form of the affidavit. And I don't believe that the appellant's affidavit properly pled out or made any integration claim. The only claim that she made is that, and made the assertion that the respondent agreed to the fact that the minor child is living with her when he's not at the boarding school. And I would disagree that the respondent has agreed to that. It has been a situation that has been essentially forced upon him by virtue of the fact that the minor child attends school and the minor child's preference. The minor child is 17 years old. We call him a minor child. He's 17 years old, and he has chosen to not spend time with his dad. The respondent has made attempts, has gone to the boarding school on at least one occasion and has made an attempt to see his son, but the son doesn't want to see him. And just because a son doesn't want to have parenting time with a parent doesn't, in my opinion, rise to the level of the integration claim. Counsel cites the Ross case. The Ross case is a distinctly different set of facts. In that case, the mother in that case had sole physical custody of the minor child. The minor child wanted to live with the father in that case. And in this case, the fact pattern is distinctly different. The parties have joint physical custody. There is a provision in the judgment and decree about how parenting time is supposed to be established. And that goes back to the issue about the flight schedules. I think the court properly determined that given the facts of the case as they exist in 2019, there wasn't any reason for the respondent to produce flight schedules because the fact of the matter is that he hasn't been able to exercise the parenting time, again, in large part because of the fact that the minor child is attending boarding school on the East Coast.
Ms. Hunza, follow up then on the integration, and this is in part a follow-up of Judge Cochran's question. What do you believe was missing from the affidavit? And because that would give us perspective about integration based on what the case law says about integration into the family that would allow us to say the court did not abuse its discretion in declining to set an evidentiary hearing with regard to integration.
Well, I think that the integration claim requires the moving party to A, prove that the child has integrated into the family of the moving party with the consent of the other party, and that this change that has occurred in the child or the parties serves the best interests of the child. And I think that the integration claim has not been met. The child has not been integrated into the home of the moving party, the appellant in this case. The child is basically integrated in large part to the boarding school and probably spends less time with mom in this case because of the fact that the child is at the boarding school, acknowledging that on breaks and in the summer that he would also spend time with mom. But the integration is not with the consent of the respondent in this case.
How would you define integration?
I think the Ross case outlines it in a situation where the child is integrated into the home of the other parent. Integrated, what would the definition be? You know, that they are in that home exclusively, as opposed to, I guess being in the home of the other parent. But in this case, I don't think that the integration hasn't occurred with the consent of the respondent. I think that's the big fact that's missing. With respect to the evidentiary hearing, the district court has the discretion to determine whether or not the moving papers have presented a prima facie case. And I would suggest that the court properly analyzed the evidence and determined that the prima facie case had not been met and that they denied the request for the evidentiary hearing.
But Ms. Counsel, the way I read the district court's decision is they're looking at the prima facie case for the endangerment, which is more directly pled and just didn't address one way or the other. But tell me if you think I'm wrong about this, the integration issue.
I agree that the court order didn't specifically use the word integration. I come back to the notice of motion and the affidavit didn't specifically allege that was one of the bases for the requested change of custody and parenting time. My read of the evidence in the affidavit from the appellant was that she was alleging endangerment for the minor child based on the endangerment statute, and I think the court agreed that there hadn't been sufficient evidence of endangerment that would require an evidentiary hearing. The other issues, just briefly before the court, are the appellant's argument that the district court abused its discretion in denying the appellant's request for the flight schedules. I would assert that the appellant, or that the district court, properly ruled that the flight schedules were not intended to lead to admissible evidence. While they were important for determining parenting time, when the parenting time was occurring and prior to the minor child having been enrolled in the East Coast boarding school, there really isn't any reason for the respondent in this case to have to produce flight schedules for the past 2 years. I mean, nobody disputes the facts that the parenting time hasn't occurred. I think the big debate is why it hasn't occurred. And so the fact that the flight schedules would not lead to admissible evidence, I think, was appropriately concluded by the district court. And then finally, the appellant is challenging the district court's award of conduct-based attorney's fees. The award is not necessarily based on the decision as it relates to custody and parenting time. There were significant other issues that the appellant raised before the district court that are not part of this appeal, that were in part the rationale for the attorney fees. The appellant requested that the respondent contribute a significant amount to the child's expenses, concluding that previous orders required the appellant to pay the tuition, a significant portion of the expenses that were being requested related to the tuition. The appellant was requesting that the respondent submit some 529 records. The court appropriately concluded that the only reason that they hadn't been produced was that appellant was failing to provide the respondent with the address. So there was, in my opinion, sufficient factual basis for the court to award the conduct-based attorney's fees, and that the court did not abuse its discretion in making said award. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansa. And Mr. Gilbert, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And the clock will be set here in a moment. Very well, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to clarify the record, the March 30th, 2020 order from the Court of Appeals, it wasn't just an added duty that Mr. Warrington received. It was a 40% increase in income that he ultimately received by moving to Memphis, Tennessee. With regard to the integration, Ms. Warrington's motion, which is labeled as 887 in the addendum, clearly identifies that pursuant to 518.18, she's asking to modify both parenting time and custody. And 518.18 includes both integration as well as endangerment. Her memorandum of law describes at length, as a bold character, this is why integration has occurred. Her affidavit, as we've described, identifies that the parties have agreed. This is their implicit agreement that integration has occurred. In Ms. Warrington's...
Can I just ask, Mr. Gilbert,
yes.
Pointing to her affidavit, what specific fact allegation does she make, would you point us to, in which she says he's been integrated into her family?
Bear with me, Your Honor. And again, the fact, it's cited in appellant's reply brief, and it's AA11 is the cite to the addendum, when respondent clearly, or appellant clearly identifies that respondent and I have reached an agreement, whether implicit or not, that I will care for Cooper and be his custodian. This agreement is evidenced by respondent refusing to exercise parenting time with Cooper and me being left to make custodial decisions on his behalf. So that's more than sufficient for a claim of integration. That's also coincides with the record where father hasn't exercised parenting time in over 3 years now. So this is clearly pled.
Mr. Gilbert.
Go ahead, Judge Slater.
Well, I was just going to follow up with that. Did the court make a finding? You heard what Ms. Hansa said, and I don't recall seeing it, but did the court make a finding that indeed an agreement had been reached?
No, there's no analysis whatsoever regarding Ms. Warrington's integration claim. Along with that, with regard to integration, we cited a case called Gibson, which describes that the party shouldn't look to, or the court should not look to the subjective intent of the parties, but should look towards, you know, what's in the best interest of the child. And again, there's different cases providing for integration of families that have been as few as 6 months as far as a different schedule being followed. This is over 3 years now. Along with that, with regard to attorney's fees, there's no factual findings regarding attorney's fees related to a request for reimbursement of extracurricular expenses. There's case law citing that if that's a basis, there needs to be specific factual findings identifying what the conduct is. Instead, the district court found that that there is no legal or factual basis for Ms. Warrington's claim to modify both custody and parenting time. And again, since the integration claim was never analyzed, the district court actually made a factual finding saying Cooper does not want to see Mr. Warrington, which again is essentially our claim under Ross that it would be endangerment to deny a child his wishes. As I had previously described, the child's uncle filed an affidavit too describing the abandonment. He describes, "I have witnessed in amazement how Cooper has literally been abandoned by his father. Respondent has not spent time with his son in over 2 years. I have seen firsthand how respondent has continually lied and manipulated the narrative surrounding Cooper, which I believe is a form of abuse as that behavior tremendously impacts Cooper during a particularly important time in his life. To continue to allow for this behavior to be bestowed upon Cooper by his father would be a life-altering mistake and would continue to negatively impact Cooper." It looks like I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today and your briefing, and we will take the matter under advisement, issue an order in the 90-day statutory time period. We wish you both a great day.
Thank you.
Matters now adjourned.